This is a session on environmental racism, and although I have a certain way going with this, basically I'm going to let people, let the spirit lead them to find where they feel environmental racism exists or is with the introductory materials. And to start it, where environmental racism is from a Christian perspective, meaning where, how best can we use our understanding of Christianity to help us in combating and not creating environmental racism. Because since Christians represent the largest proportion of this nation, it's not surprising, therefore, that most of the environmental damage that has occurred may have been from people who call themselves Christians. That doesn't mean that they're going about their lives with this idea, but it can happen. So we're going to first start, and I'm going to introduce myself, and then I want as many people as feel comfortable introduce themselves, let you know who you are, where you're from, and one further thing about yourself. I'm Steve Mercurio, and I come from the city of Mankato, Minnesota, and I would like to emphasize city there. So I come from the city, and that tells you a little bit about me. I'm a lay person. I'm not a pastor. I'm actually a biologist by training, a psychologist. But the main thing is that I come from the city, and the next part that I'd like people to tell me if they feel comfortable is what happens when they flush the toilet. Where does it go? Okay? In my case, when I flush the toilet, it goes out of my house, on a nice middle-class neighborhood, and it goes downtown, is at a sewage treatment plant in the old part of town, and then winds up in the Minnesota River, and then ultimately winds up in the Mississippi. In the northern part of Mississippi, it starts flowing down that way. And that's what happens when I flush the toilet. And so when I flush, it winds up first downtown, it winds up downtown, then into the Minnesota River, and then into the Mississippi, and we know where that goes.
Where it used to go.
And we know that people draw water, M-I-S-S-I-S-S. So that's what happens to my stuff when I flush. And it's knowledge that is tells us what are we doing with it. Does anybody can start? You know, it'd be nice to have some people who don't live in the cities to talk about.
Sure.
My name is Don Wilson. I live in a little town, or near a little town, of Centralia, Washington.
So you're rural?
Rural. And when I flush, it goes out into my new $7,000 septic tank, and then percolates down into the ground and comes back through my well.
So in other words, but basically what you're saying, that as a rural person, that when you flush, it goes into your own property, and you deal with your own waste, your own stuff. Would anybody else like to talk who's either from a city or rural area? Yes.
My name is George Jones. I'm from Renton, Washington, but the suburban,
okay,
out of town area. I have a septic tank.
Okay.
I'd just like to make a statement about centralized sewage systems, if I can. Being an engineer, this is something you learn. Sewage systems, centralized sewage systems you're talking about, are the single contributor in this century to improve public health.
I understand that. But I just want to know where it goes. Okay? I understand that it's improving public health. And certain septic systems and, you know, drainage ditches and all that sort of stuff aren't good for us. But I just want to know where it goes. Okay? It stays around your area.
Well, yeah, we have very rocky soil, so it percolates very well.
And
I'm Clarence Oliver, and I live in the suburb of Houston, and I have a septic system.
Okay.
But I lived in New Orleans for 6-7 years. I might have had some of your what you flushed to drink.
That's exactly right. What else? Anybody else from any of these areas? Sure.
Well, I think ours is treated, and then it ends up probably into the Missouri, and I guess
your city?
Pierce, South Dakota, small,
your city?
Small town.
Okay.
And once that happens, I guess I think it's much better than if somebody goes out and just uses a hole in the yard and it comes down through the water.
Okay.
I mean, we have to have something.
But, okay.
So it doesn't really bother me. It's
anybody
just
else
my body's in the ground, doesn't bother me.
Excellent.
I'm from
Fredericksburg, Texas.
Okay, and that's a?
Small city, 7,000.
Okay, small city.
We have a system that goes into the treatment plant.
Okay, and that's
why? From there it goes into a pond, and from there they pump it out to the golf course, to some of it, the water the golf course, and others, there's a big sprinkler goes on the field where they raise coastal. But they used to sell this coastal, mm-hmm. and now the last year they won't let them sell it except for horse feed. They say that they won't let them feed it to cows and so.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Excellent. I think what we're starting to see is a little pattern. People in cities have their waste taken away from them and given to somebody else. People in rural areas handle their own. Now, I'm not saying that's good or bad, but there's this magical stuff with cities. It's magic because you put your garbage at the curb and it disappears. You put your stuff in the toilet and it goes away. Do you know who lives next to your treatment plant? Do you know the neighborhood? Do you know the people there? Do you know the people who live next to the rivers? The thing with cities is people don't ask to have their houses built by, hey, I have a Ponderosa landfill where my garbage goes to. I don't want to build my house by the Ponderosa landfill. It's a state Superfund site. And yet if I send my garbage there, who gets to live by the Ponderosa landfill? Do I care about those people? Am I a good Christian in allowing what I think is icky stuff, or you know, things that I don't want to deal with in the house, that I pass it off to somebody else and say that they have to live with it, next to it, drink it, or whatever? I'm not saying that it's good or bad, septics versus centralized systems, but it's a mindset that you can send your garbage or your pollution away, and versus a person who has to deal with it continuously. If a farmer sprays on their own field, they have to deal with the upshot of that spraying in their own community. That's where the
we had a mayor who said, everybody wants their garbage picked up, mm-hmm. but nobody wants it put down.
Yeah. But do you see that there seems to be, you agree that there's a rural mindset and that there's a city mindset? Cities magically, or city-like areas, magically the pollution goes away from them to somebody else. Rural mindsets are such that they deal with their own, and they're more cognizant of their own creations and ways of handling it.
I think I would agree with you just by observing some things around here. I've been here long enough to have garbo duty a couple times, mm-hmm. which is a very interesting process, really. And I think that the village would do well to have everyone, guests included, do garbo duty. Mm-hmm. But the thing I notice is that most people think it smells so bad. They go, oh, pew, and they can't look at it, and
yes.
Some people actually gag.
Yes.
And I grew up on a farm in South Dakota, and all of a sudden memories were triggered for me with that. And it wasn't bad. It was what we took our stuff out of the house and threw it over a fence to hogs, mostly, or buried some mm-hmm. of it. Mm-hmm. But it's just interesting. I realized from a rural background, I didn't think it smelled bad. Most people did.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, if we go back into the Bible, there was a rural mindset and a city mindset. People in Jerusalem thought that they were on top of the world and everybody else was scum. Okay? As a matter of fact, what did they say about Jesus? What good could come from Nazareth? He comes from Nazareth. He's a hick. We have all sorts of really nasty phrases for people in rural areas. But we don't have a whole lot of nasty phrases for city folk, other than they're city-fied or something. But they're looked up to. They went to the city. Wow, that's pretty impressive. But rural knowledge has no height. And yet, what did Jesus use in his parables? Did he say, a man went to downtown, or a woman went downtown, and went to the finest temple and got the best knowledge, and that's the way to the kingdom of heaven. Let me read from Matthew 13. The same day Jesus went out of the house and sat behind the sea, and great crowds gathered around him, so that he got into a boat and sat there. And the whole crowd stood on the beach, and he told them many things in parables, saying, a sower went out to sow. And that was the beginning of one parable. And we can do it again and again. It's rural knowledge. It's sowing. It's seeds. It's harvesting. It's the rural knowledge that he's pushing. He's using rural parable. When they talk about the city, it's Matthew chapter 23, verse 37. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, killing the prophets and stoning those who are sent to you. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not. Behold, your house is forsaken and desolate, and perhaps we can say polluted. Cities, and if you go to anthropologists and talk to them, they'll say, yes, there's a stratification in the city. In a rural area, everybody is fairly equal. In a city, there's a stratification that occurs. And there are some that get to live on the lower end and the higher end. And it starts happening. Rural versus city is the beginning of a regionalism, if not racism. But who gets to live in those regions that aren't so good? The outgroup. Let's take a look at Jerusalem at the time of Jesus. I have from Jerusalem a history of 40 centuries, some information, and then I have something from London from 1595, a brief description of Jerusalem here with an H. But it's basically, this is fascinating when you read what Jerusalem was like. Now we hear about the Fish Gate and the Gate of Women's Towers and lovely gates, but how many have heard about, and I have a map here if anybody wants to look where it is, the Dung Gate. The Dung Gate on the east side of the city toward the corner gate on the northeast carried all the dung and filth of the city, which the rain gathered together into the brook Cedron. Whereupon it was rightly called the Dung Gate. There was a polluting channel out of Jerusalem. Do you think that the scribes and the Pharisees got to live on Dung Gate? Who got to live within the city of Jerusalem and get to drink from the river Cedron? Who was outside of Jerusalem? In Jerusalem were the high Jewish scribes, etc. And it was the Gentile, the one who, the you know, who were not worthy to come to the temple, who got to live outside the walls of the city. The beginnings of an environmental racism is pointed out here just by how things are designed. Not because they're trying to be racist necessarily in their environmental, but that they don't, they're pushing their filth to an area of people they don't care about. So environmental destruction is not in a rural, it's destroying, it's self-destruction. In a city, it is destroying others. It is putting it toward people of lower economic status, etc., who cannot afford not to live in the poor part of the town, etc. So they knew this at this time. As a matter of fact, you'll find very few references in the Bible about rural people talking about hell. Rural people didn't have a real good viewpoint of what hell was. But the city people knew hell because it existed physically for them. There was physical hell outside Jerusalem. It wasn't in the city. It was outside the city gates. Near the Dung Gate was a place the Greeks called Gehenna, but really is called Gehinnom, the Valley of Hinnom, where children were supposedly sacrificed. And this was a great pollution, a place of great pollution. It was hell. And there's a physical place that this was outside Jerusalem. They knew where it was. And they knew where the filth of Jerusalem went. Literally the filth of Jerusalem. And it flowed probably toward this area. They had burning garbage and things like that outside the city gates. And who got to live there? The Gentile. Let's turn the picture around a few years later. When the Gentiles were now in control, as Christians, And the Jews were now in the out group. Let's turn the tables. I'm going to read something from The Merchant of Venice, and then I want you to take sides. Okay? I want you to take sides and tell me which one of these people you'd rather be associated with. We have Shylock, who is a greedy character, a Jewish greedy character who really demands certain things. And I'm going to read you from Portia, and it sounds absolutely beautiful. Let's read from both of them. Here is from The Merchant of Venice, and Shylock says the following. Okay. If you want to know what this is, it's Act 3. It's Act 3, Scene 1. Shylock says, in refuting what other people said, to bait fish withal, if it will nothing else, it will feed my revenge. He hath disgraced me and hindered me half a million, laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heathened my enemies, and what's his reason? I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes, hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? We are like you in the rest. We will resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge. If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferings be by Christian example? Why revenge? The villainy you teach me, I will execute, and it shall go hard, but I will better the instruction, is what Shylock says. A rather bitter man. Portia, who is at this point disguised as a judge, says the following later on, Act 4, Scene 1. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven. Upon the place beneath, it is twice blessed. It blesseth him that, or her that gives, and he or she that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest, it becomes his it becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty, wherein doth sit and dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above the sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings. It is an attribute to God himself. And earthly power doth then show God likest gods when mercy seasons justice. Therefore, Jew, though justice be thy plea, consider this, that in the course of justice none of us should see salvation. We do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy. I have spoken thus much to mitigate the justice of thy plea, which if thou follow, the strict court of Venice must give sentence against the merchant here. There. Who would you rather side with? Who is telling the message that Christians should take? Shylock or Portia? How many go for Portia? I go for Shylock. Should I explain why? What was Shylock, basically? A usurer. What was the only occupation allowed Jews during that time? Usury. And they were damned for it. And if they used Christian forgiveness, was used as a weapon against them, and said, you must forgive all debts because that's forgiveness, they would starve. Their families would starve. They would go out of business. They would die. In that case, the Christian forgiveness is to them a weapon which can kill them, because they're given the job of handling the dung. We don't see it that way because Portia's message is beautiful. And yet we don't realize that Shylock, even though he be an embittered soul, has to make his living by usury because they don't allow him any other. Who do we damn today the same way? Can anybody think of an example? Who is an outgroup that we damn the same way for doing something that is pretty disreputable, but is their only form of economic power these days?
Prostitution.
That's one example for some women. How about pick a racial group? Gambling?
Migrant labor.
Yeah, but gambling on the Indians is one very close one to usury. Because we damned the Indians now for having that power, and it's the only power they were given. And yet, didn't we dump the nuclear waste sites on tribal lands? Don't we put our refuse out to tribal lands? Where were we when they were starving? Where were we when they had poor education? They are our Shylocks, who we despise. We created Shylock, just like these Christians created Shylock years ago. The Christian ethic of forgiveness is to have do something for the oppressed so that they can forgive us. Not tell them they have to forgive us for what we're doing to them and forgive us to the point where they die. And they are... Yes?
He mentioned migrant farm workers.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the poor sanitation of where they live and work and mm-hmm. pesticides in the fields, I'd have to agree.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's again part of it. But there's such a distinct thing with you see, the migrant workers haven't had necessarily a lot of economic gain yet, so they're not envied. You remember the Jewish banker stereotype? It came from this usury, which was created by Christians. Christianity did not allow usury among Christians, and therefore they needed somebody to do their dirty work for them. Similar to the Jews needed somebody to do their dirty work for them back in the time of Jesus, Christians needed somebody to do their dirty work then, and we still require somebody to do our dirty work now.
I don't understand why usury is such dirty work.
Oh, it was horrible. I mean, to lend money so that, and gain interest on it?
Christians could not, at that time, engage in any of this interest exchange.
When did it change?
In the 1600s, after the discovery of the New World, and it became seriously profitable to the church to charge and
any
collect
interest at all.
Then it changed. Prior to, say, Cortez's conquering of the Aztecs, there was basically no permissible charging of interest by Christians under any circumstances.
And the Muslims have the same thing.
The House of Fugger in Germany was Jewish.
Exploration required debt.
Required large capital, and that's the way you could get it, yeah.
And the Muslims still feel that way today. Mm-hmm. They're still not usually allowed among Islam. They find it not one of your top professions to go into. There are a lot of people go into business, but will not go into the loaning of money and usury, because that's not allowed. So we'll find, yes?
I was just thinking, Steve, because it was, I hiked in with a man who was an executive in Georgia Pacific, and he is, an observation along these lines is that another despised group is the business person today who is perceived as polluting the environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's another twist on that.
Right.
And not to complicate the issue, but he is a part of a group who's doing dirty work for a lot of us who use paper and products and so mm-hmm. forth and so on. At the same time, the government and the agencies are beginning to crack down and get really hard on them.
Yes, that's true. However, the question is the businessman part of an oppressed group as well? And that becomes racism. You see, it becomes racist.
So you're talking about the racist.
Right. In other words, environmentalism is not basically pollution. Environmental destruction is not basically pollution. It's not caring about the next person down the line who gets to see your waste stream.
Say that again.
It's not caring about the next person who comes in contact with your waste stream. If you really cared about them, you would follow the truck all the way to the site and say, don't dump it here, dump it rather in my backyard. I love this person. I know this person, I care about this person, I would never let that happen to them, because I would never let it happen to me or my family, and I care a lot about them.
Sure.
And when we start realizing that, we realize pollution cannot occur, because it's all downstream pollution. In other words, I flush with the idea that I don't get to see it anymore, and then I don't worry about it. It's not a conscious racist decision.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, socioeconomically, we know who lives in the worst sections, by the garbage dumps, by the factories that are putting out the smoke. The people with the most money and the most power in society live furthest away on the hill.
Mm-hmm.
You remember how all the nicest houses were always put on hills and overlooked the valleys? Because the waste could go down with gravity, or south with the flow of the rivers, or just away. Mm-hmm. Just away. And city thought is its magic. There's the city. I grew up in the city. It's magic, you know. There's lots of magic in cities. You put it out, it disappears. You flush, it goes away. Up to the time of Sir Thomas Cracker, who invented the toilet flush toilet, it never went away. And as a matter of fact, it was never viewed as much more than, you know, sometimes it was a resource. In certain countries, you know, you spread it over your field. When you don't have the field to spread it over, it becomes a waste, a pollutant that must be gotten away from.
It seems to me that, you know, what we have is a problem between areas with small populations. I mean, the rural, there's an advantage to being rural, too. I mean, we talk about them, right? I hear us kind of talking as though rural is somehow superior because they deal with their own waste, but they don't have the problem of concentrated population.
Not superior. A different mindset.
Well, yeah, but I think that mindset is created maybe by size of population. Obviously, when you have apartments, you can't spread, you know, your waste product over your garden.
Right.
I mean, you're in a whole, you have to deal with your problems in a different way. And
yes, but there's a certain magical portion to apartments.
Sure, sure. But I guess what I would say is then, you talk in language of being the Christian and following the garbage truck and saying, take it back, put it on my property. Obviously, that's not going to occur.
Right.
I guess the next question is, mm-hmm. how then, what are the types of solutions for a city situation then that you would propose?
Mm-hmm. Well, one suggestion by the Land Institute is to put a lot more people in the rural areas where they belong and away from the cities. That's redistribution of people back onto the land to recreate those rural communities. Instead of having people all concentrated in cities with no jobs, etc. I mean, why do we have all this corporate farming going on?
Is that realistic?
Yeah, I guess people flock to the cities. You know, how do you reverse that trend?
No, but that's one solution. But what else would you suggest?
Well, I don't have a suggestion.
But I'm talking in terms of the location of these sites and things like that. For example, it always will be located in the worst part of town with the people who are most likely to be impacted, children who are already least fed.
In a way, it doesn't have to be located in the worst part of town.
That's correct.
I mean, you know, I'm from the West Coast, from the Seattle area. The big metro sewage plant, the big one, okay, mm-hmm. is right across the freeway from the big shopping mall. It's right across the freeway from where Boeing is building their world headquarters. It doesn't have to be.
Okay.
Okay. Ask these people in here about their sewage treatment plant. Find out if they know if it's primary, mm-hmm. if it's secondary, or by some miracle, they have a tertiary treatment plant.
Right.
Probably most people don't have a clue.
Right.
What are you talking about, primary sewage?
We got a sewage plant, okay? We got a sewage plant. But that ain't that isn't the miracle.
But the interesting thing is, from what you're saying, it's people don't know what's happening. And within there, they don't know what they're doing. I mean, and that's part of the subtlety why people get upset when they're called environmental racists. Because it's subtle. It's not that they want necessarily to do somebody bad. They don't want to deliver garbage to somebody's house by a landfill. They do not want to send it to an incinerator to be burnt by somebody's house. But by the nature of the beast, the ignorance is leading to solutions which are not the best solutions. And yet, perhaps there are some cities and some areas which are doing it right. There are many who are going by the dung gate and still have the lowest portion of the population.
There used to be many more.
Excuse me?
There used to be many more.
Steve?
Yes?
I think it'd be worthwhile, just as a matter of interest and information for him to explain primary, secondary, and tertiary. I mean, I know, but
sure.
I a lot of people here clearly don't, and there's a lot of question marks around.
Well, I'll try my best. I'm not a sewage treatment person, but in primary, you basically bring the water in and you settle out all the things you can settle out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And they have the floaters and the sinkers, and the water just goes about its merry way.
Mm-hmm.
And you do something with the floaters and the sinkers, maybe
right.
you compost them. Secondary, you take that water that came off and you treat it biologically
mm-hmm.
and produce an activated sludge. The water is a whole lot cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
But not necessarily recyclable.
Right.
Tertiary is a very bad, can be defined as zero water discharge, or recyclable water, or extremely clean water. In other words, as good as you got it out of the stream thing.
Exactly.
That's can be extraordinarily expensive. Mm-hmm. Most big communities, they're trying to get them to at least get to secondary sewage treatment. Most communities have primary sewage treatment, if they have a river nearby to dump it into.
Is there water involved?
Always.
Yeah. Is there what?
Water. Odor. Odor, yes.
I was curious about, do you believe that it has a lot to do with political power? It seems like the poor and disenfranchised do not have political power, so they are going to get dumped on.
Well, that seems to be some of that.
Because why isn't the rural area saying, we're not going to take your sewage?
Well, they don't have any power to say not. For example, in Mankato, we burn all the garbage for St. Paul, and which is the capital city, and the surrounding areas, because we were told we were going to.
Yeah, but why?
Because the state has the ability to set those regulations.
If the people in power lived in Mankato, though.
It would wind up someplace else.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
The thing is not to point fingers at that way, but rather to investigate how we use Christianity. Are we using it in a way which is a positive influence to help the disenfranchised and not to make other people feel bad, for example, that they have come up against an industry and said, I think this is a polluter. Whether it is or not, they're disenfranchised and they point and they say, this is a polluter. And the polluter says, you apologize to us. You owe us an apology. We're Christians. You're not.
But in that way, you're assuming that people in power are Christian and
in this nation, is that not true?
No.
I think they will claim they are.
I'm not talking about practicing Christianity the way the Bible says, but do they go to church every Sunday?
Not really.
I understand that.
Define themselves as Christian.
That's right. Define themselves as Christian. However, it's hard. We have whole churches involved in this. I mean, this is not, when it comes to jobs and things like that, they said, you got to support your Christian community. And that means supporting the industry as the first.
But I think living in D.C., as I see some things up close, I don't think I want to be waiting around for the Christians to come in and save our problems.
Right.
And there's something very immediate right now, and that's why I bring up, how are we going to deal with this until... You know, if you want to focus on the Christian population, what the Christians should do, what happens for, the next millennium when it's not going to happen and when political power is the actual power that moves? And
well, there are many things that can be done by, later on in the week we'll get into advocacy and how it really can function and work. And you can have some really powerful things happen that come out of churches, to advocacy groups that actually become state laws and federal laws and other things like that, and then their local community efforts in terms of improving the conditions of those in certain areas, which a lot of Christian groups are doing. I'm just saying that there are a lot of solutions. We're just looking for, right now, some of the things that, in our own sphere of influence, redefines for us what is environmental destruction and why it might also be environmental racism.
Well, I was just going to... on the churches. I mean, the neighborhood where I live, in fact, the churches are organizing protests and advocacy and so forth because the New York City government wants to put a sewage incinerator in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And the neighborhood is up in arms saying, but in my mind, I mean, what's the Christian thing to do? Should the churches be, advocating for not putting it there? It's a more politically powerful neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the Christian thing to do? I think we should go ahead and put it there. It's our sewage has to be burned someplace. Let's put it in our neighborhood. But the churches, on the other hand, I think are exaggerating the danger of it, and what is the Christian thing to do? What the churches are doing and saying, put it someplace else in the poor person's neighborhood, or is the Christian thing to say, hey, put it right in the middle of my backyard?
Well, that's part of it. And if you think it's designed well, like this tertiary system, you wouldn't be unhappy with it. Mm-hmm. And yet, if it's a bad system, you don't want it anywhere, but you know that if you shove it out of your backyard, it's going to wind up in somebody else's, who's likely to be less powerful and more disenfranchised and more voiceless. And so when you push it away from your backyard or say, we need another solution to this, you got to find out where it winds up and not just let it go and say, it's like the toilet. I flushed it. It's now away from me. I don't have to think about it anymore.
When you push it out of your backyard, you've got to find out whose backyard it wound up in and still stand in solidarity with them and say, it doesn't belong in their backyard either. Now what are you going to do? Either stop creating it or find another solution to it. You know, there are other options. And, you know, the thing is, by putting it on the disenfranchised, you don't have to think about options. It's gone.
Well, I'm from South Dakota also. And there are places in our state that are so economically depressed that there are people begging to get to take the garbage.
Yes.
And so solidarity is a very interesting term where, on the one hand, they would say solidarity is to support bringing the toxic waste. And it's a very difficult dilemma for me to imagine what empowerment means. And I want to say that empowerment is to say, you don't have to take it. But it isn't that simple.
But you could say to them, this is what toxic waste does if it's stored a certain way. You need the best of systems, and this is what you need to see in your systems, because this is what I'd want in my backyard if toxic waste were stored there. And then go push for those BACT, which is the term you use, best available control technology, for them. So that if it is an economic advantage to them, it doesn't years later become a noose around their neck because they didn't see any other way out. There are also other ways of, you know, economically bringing in economic consulting and things to see if they have any other alternatives. I mean, there are ways of being because we have to look at community to community. There isn't one given answer, but that's why this is a theological problem. Because politically and scientifically, we can say, well, this is what should be done. What is one person against a million, you know? And, you know, we have to redefine that.
We've been living in Meadow Lake in northern Saskatchewan, and not long after we moved there, Norman announced it was building a pulp mill in town. And I was quite active in the environmental group, and my first response was, you know, Blanche, this is something to be fought tooth and nail. Mm-hmm. And it did not take me long in my involvement with this environmental group to realize that the people I was involved with they were ready to spike trees and plant bombs and do whatever was necessary to make sure that the pulp mill was not built in Meadow Lake. Where it was built, they didn't care, but not there. And I realized that I was in a very different place, that, yeah, I didn't really want the pulp mill there either. But if it was going to be built there, and after a while it looked like there was no ifs, ands, or buts, and it is now there and running, we need to have the best possible pulp mill that technology could crunch out. Mm-hmm. And once it was built, need to be monitored like a bunch of hawks, mm-hmm, to make sure that it maintained the standards that it claimed it could maintain. Given the fact that, yeah, the world wants paper, and all of us read books, and I myself probably do too many of them.
We built your wastewater treatment plant.
But you see, the thing is, the nice thing is now this is the dilemma of the perspective that we're trying to get at. We're now not in a racist mode of thinking. We're in the Christian mode of thinking as we were talking about. Jesus would sit and eat with the taxpayers and prostitutes and all these other, in probably areas that leper colonies. You know, all the worst places. Why do you think they got some of these diseases? You think the sanitary conditions were all that great in those parts? It was because they probably, all this garbage was shoved at them, and they weren't given the best of anything, and they were on the disenfranchised list to begin with, and so it just turned out that way. And so we have all that, and he goes out and is with them there. And so I think, really, the church has a lot to say in this area. Because a lot of times they say, oh, you're a bunch of know-nothings. I mean, you're just naive and do-gooders and stuff like that, and you know nothing about science. You don't have to talk science. That's the neat part. You do not have to talk science to talk the solutions. You do not have to know science to know the solutions. You know the solutions are always what fits the region, what the people want, that is also the best for them. And that it's not, you don't look at it from the perspective of, what do I get out of this? You get the point of view from them. What do they get out of this? And then we...
Who sits on the pedestal, though, and makes those decisions?
The people
because they are technical decisions in a complex society.
Yes, there is a need for technology, and there are needs for technologists within the decision-making process. But it can be explained at the layperson level. It really can. I do it all the time. And that's why it's necessary to lay out the solutions in front of people and say, here are the cost options, and here are the increased risks of not using that cost option. And then define what is reasonable, and a community can define it too. And you don't define it by the most powerful. You go to the people who most likely would be impacted, and you say, what do you think about this? That doesn't mean it always happens that way. But basically, if we're going to believe that Jesus' teachings really speak not to those who are healed, not to those who are powerful, but those who need a healing and are not powerful, then we have to start thinking in terms of that. Otherwise, we risk, you know, solutions which become final solutions for those populations.
I have one comment and one question. The comment is, some of this sounds impossible or highly unlikely. And then I think, is it surprising? No, I don't think it is surprising that quite a bit of what the Bible tells us to do sounds impossible or highly unlikely.
Right,
then my question is, in addition to the rural city two perspectives you were asking us to consider, how about more examples? Do you have some examples about what crosses national boundaries, or what is shipped from one place to another place where they speak a different language or have a different...
Easy. All air pollution crosses those kind of boundaries. Anything you put into the air...
Acid rain.
Acid rain, mercury contamination, which all comes from incineration and power production by fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that cross national boundaries easily.
Anything that goes through the St. Lawrence River system.
I think there's even more deliberate examples. That's sort of, I think, indirect or maybe involuntary. There's a lot more than that. I mean, like, a lot of toxic waste ends up in third world countries because we were talking about South Dakota, not that it's a third world country. But I know, I mean, there's villages in West Africa that are just being decimated by various diseases because they're... gullies are filling up with barrels of leaking toxic waste because of the unscrupulous national leaders are raking in millions of dollars and just dumping it in the nearest village's water supply, and no one's saying a word about it. They don't have an EPA in many countries.
Yes.
Oh, South Dakota, yeah. Because it has been a very controversial thing. And the one that we were talking about, they have got some of the best toxic waste I don't know what you call those things, digs or proposed, that money and technology has come up with.
Right.
And I guess if I were to vote, I'd say bring them in. That community wants them in. They are some of the best that we know how to put in those areas. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, but I make toxic waste. I had cancer. I used iodine treatment. That's toxic. Mm-hmm. Anybody that's been to Rochester or been through any of those treatment plants,
right,
that's toxic.
Sure.
Why shouldn't South Dakota take some too? I don't know. I think it's...
As long as you know what it means. As long as you make sure that...
What does it mean? It meant my
life. No, because there are... No, I'm talking about the plant. If there's a spill.
Plant, yes.
If there's a spill or anything, are there children in the neighborhood? Is there a daycare center around there, etc.?
There's going to be no matter where you go.
No, but you can design it best away from some of those spots. Well, best design, best location. Best location a lot of times... For example, the first place they were going to locate a landfill was over a cracked sort of area, which would have been illegal, but that was the first choice because it was cheap. The second choice became right next to a river, and because that's where the past landfill would have been. They could have picked another location, but it would have been much more difficult to obtain and possibly more expensive to obtain that as a solution.
But you're still talking about moving out of the populated to the unpopulated, or to the more sparsely populated.
Not necessarily. It doesn't have to go that way. I mean,
but it is.
It does go that way for the most part. Yes.
Seattle and the Tacoma area are sending trainloads of solid garbage down by rail through Portland, up the Columbia River, and dumping into the center part of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
INAL, I'm from Idaho, mm-hmm. as Walt is, and toxic waste are coming in from Connecticut and Massachusetts, and we're fighting it coming into Idaho, where it's dumped into the desert out there,
mm-hmm.
into the subterranean
aquifer.
And it's a big problem, but it's always going to go out to the rural areas.
Mm-hmm. And that's
these large waste areas. The
maybe that's responsible. I mean, we're moving it away from the population.
We're going to get through a lot of population.
Yeah.
No. Because we don't have a political clout to keep that reactor waste out.
Okay.
We have a small population base. It's two senators, two representatives.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, we have a similar situation in South Dakota too, Lone Tree, which is out in the middle north. The reason it goes to the rural areas is because there is nothing there. For example, it's tough to get water. You know, in a lot of cases, you can't get water.
No.
And the terrain, for one thing that's very important to disposal waste, is adequate in the rural areas where it's not in the city areas.
Okay.
All of those things lend toward putting it where the scientists think it's the best.
Now, I have a question for you. When you look at the map of the United States and you see where all the Native American reservations are, where were these people located? On the best land or in the rural areas where there was nothing? That was the first Holocaust, okay? What's the second one? Where are many of these sites located? If you do statistics on where most of the chemical dump sites are, they're around minority black populations, Native American reservations, etc. It's not just in the white rural farm areas. It really seems to find its way. Somehow, some magical way, it finds its way into these sites. I'm just saying that is as a possible alternative. Now, what do you do?
I think one of the main points you're trying to get us to accept and see is that whichever place it is, rural or distant or alone, that place needs to have all the knowledge at hand in order to make their choices about whether they want to do it and whether they can have the best, that kind of thing, so that these groups of people are not getting it unknown. So that they aren't getting dumped on by people who are in the know.
Or because they are in a majority.
Or in the majority.
But
this whole thing of trying to erase the ignorance.
First, his hand went up, then yours, and I'll be glad to go that way.
But isn't that a big part of what we're trying to say?
Sure.
I mean, here's a little example, and maybe it doesn't even apply, but at St. Olaf College in the springtime, we spray for dandelions.
Mm-hmm.
And in the morning I get up and get in my car, I can smell it in the air. I know they've sprayed for dandelions. But we don't post it on the lawns so that the co-eds can decide not to lie in their bikinis on there for about 3 days.
Or run their dogs through.
We don't tell them. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying that we aren't going to spray for weeds, but I wish there were signs up somewhere so you could make a choice about whether you're going to lie down there.
Yeah, and yes, and you were going to say?
Oh, one of the things of history of Native American people is, and our thoughts is that we look seven generations ahead of ourselves, so that we, in our past, would always look at our seventh generation ahead before we would do any object that we did.
That's all true.
That's somewhat ties in. My thought is that, I guess I'm uncomfortable with the city and rural contrast to some extent too, because I'm coming from a somewhat rural area.
Okay.
I know how those problems are pushed back too, and the seven generation thing I think is real helpful.
Okay.
Because right now all the farmers around us are plugging these deep wells down and draining the aquifer.
Sure.
And knowing that they're passing their problem on not to another group geographically, but to another group chronologically.
Right.
And it's not that
people in the
rural are more pure than people in the city.
No.
I mean, they're the same selfish sons of bitches that are here behind me. But I think, it's certainly self-interest motivated. And I think the frustration is for anybody that tries to go up against that, because by golly, I see the same kind of self-interest stuff in my own.
Take it back a few generations, though. What were farmers like? They were sustaining and wanted to pass it on to their children. When farmers became business people, which is a city mindset, that's when they became the same selfish, motivated. They were forced into that.
But the farmers leveled the forests.
That's true too, and that was bad too. But I'm just saying that we're looking for the origins of environmental racism here, okay? Yes, we have environmental destruction, but where are some of the origins of environmental racism? If you put your garbage on yourself, if you pollute your own land, if you slit your own throat, then you have to deal with suicide. Why are you suicidal? But it's different when you put it on somebody else because they have less power than you do. Then it's environmental racism. And that's what we're trying to define here, as apart from just general environmental destruction.
Well, when I walked in here, racism seemed almost like the wrong choice. It's almost like environmental class. It can be racial, but it can also be a class issue.
But it mostly is racism. Most of the statistics will point that it is mostly put on those groups.
Most of the examples people have been raising, the general theme seems to be it's not racism, but as you said, class. I mean, it's the children, you know, those without political power, whether it's future generations, values, you don't have a vote, children, the poor. I mean, what happens is that often the poor, the disenfranchised. Right, but it's not necessarily that. West Virginia, it's whites, and they're getting...
You always go to the exception to get away from the rule because we're scared of using the term racism.
I think racism is too small of a term. I think it's a much larger problem than that.
Yes, but when it is racism, racism kills a group. Yeah. Environmental destruction can kill all of humanity, but environmental racism targets a group and kills them in greater proportion than the regular group, and whether you know it or not, that can be more of a downfall as well. For example, in Minnesota, and I'll use it later on for environmental advocacy, the nuclear generating plant was put on Prairie Island in the Mississippi River, okay? Which is right by the Prairie Island Reservation of the Midwetonkan Sioux. We came forward as the Lutheran Coalition and supported a religious coalition saying that, not on technical grounds, but that the Sioux should be able by their right as a sovereign nation to go to the legislature and have it determined that this was either a good site or not a bad site, but they should be listened to because they have sovereign status and because they're people who have been generally oppressed in the past. Well, what happened? And I'll go into the specifics later on in the week. What happened is the power company came after us with guns blaring, asked for an apology from the Sioux, and said they should help them find a federal site when the Sioux know that it would be probably sited on another reservation if a federal had a permanent site. That's where most of the sightings are for the federal site, on another reservation. We still are getting major flack from employees of the power company who are Christian, telling us, why are you dealing with this non-Christian outfit? You're a Christian organization. We are good Christians, employed by a good Christian company. And don't pick on us. We give lots of money, we do this, we do that, we do the other thing. We said, we're not basing it on the technical. We just want them to have their voice. If the voice comes up and they thought they were heard and they still think that, okay, everything was done right, we're not against necessarily the whole thing happening, if their voice is heard and everything gets worked out. But we're told that no, they aren't saying that. Most of our employees who are also Native American agree with us as well. And they don't believe that there's environmental racism there. They just don't believe it. It can't be. We're not racists. We're good Christian people. We employ lots of people. We give to the United Way. And we not only give to the United Way, we're the greatest contributors to the United Way. And most of the people in this company are well placed on the church boards. One of the churches has stopped giving to the synod with the pastor backing them up. This is what I'm talking about. That when you give a Christian response, you get the flack back that, hey, and it's not like we don't care about the employees, and we don't care that we created the mess with nuclear power to begin with by, you know, requiring to have it. We're saying that part of the solution has to involve the status and the rights of these people who have a perfect right to speak up. And if there is a permanent site by state law, it should be go to the state legislature. And that's all the question is. So that's just one of the things that happens that you find in these sort of things. It's not an abstract problem.
I think it's a really powerful concept you're getting at, because what it does is it looks at it in a systemic way. It looks at it as though it is a real problem, as opposed to if we look at it as just a rural versus urban.
That's right.
Without the racial overtones, we can say, well, it's just a problem we all have to deal with.
But the rural versus urban started as a racial overtone.
That's the more basic issue.
Jerusalem was Jewish. The Gentiles were not. Don't care about those Gentiles. Matter of fact, it's better off they die off because they're not part of God. Matter of fact, God will probably cast some bad things on them. You know, they're not the chosen people. Then it came to the other place. The Christians thought talking to Christ killers who were usurers and probably weren't worth it anyway. They didn't believe in Jesus. What's wrong with them anyway? Let them die off. You know. Then beyond that, again, it happens again. And it's not, it's a precept of the society the way it's set up. You don't necessarily think that way anymore. But the society was set up with that in mind somewhere along the way. And it carries along. And that's what I mean. The city versus rural was just the way it probably got started. But it carries along the racial lines. And that's why when we read Jesus' parables and read those sort of things, we realize he didn't go to the cities to pick his disciples.
If we really take seriously what you're saying, then basically what we're seeing is that as Christians, we cannot throw up our hands and say, well, it's bigger than us, or we can't say it's not our problem, or we can't do any number of things. We have to look at it as a part of the gospel message.
Right.
And that's the part that's ringing real clear for me. It's a disturbing thing to believe.
Right.
But I think that's where I begin to notice that there's some truth there.
And don't ask for forgiveness from the person you're oppressing. Ask them to forgive you. And that's the basis of forgiveness. It's not you get to forgive me because you're attacking me and my livelihood. Instead, you're going, I understand that my livelihood is impacting you. I'm sorry about that. Can we come to a solution so my family can still live and I'm not oppressing you anymore? Mm-hmm. How can we come to a thing? That's not what's happening. It's happening. They took it to the Public Utilities Commission, etc. They bypassed the whole community. They said, oh, you were involved, but these people know better than you. And that is exactly how you talk as a racist. These people know better. They have more technology. They have more things. You don't know anything. You don't know what's best for you. But we know what's best for you. Well, the Indians have heard that a long time. We know what's best for you. You know, we know what's best for you. Well, they heard it all the way. And the Jews have heard it a long time, too. And any other press group can tell you the same thing. They've heard that line before. It may be true. But they've heard that line before. And unless they're included, unless it becomes inclusive and they become part of the solution, even though they represent a small group in an area that isn't worth very much, their voice must be at least the same as the people who are in the majority and are locating it there, so that it doesn't become a racist thing. It becomes an inclusive thing, an educating process, and that, you know, if we come to a better solution, a more Christian solution. And that's what we're going for, and I think we better stop there. We'll have more examples during the weekend. This is where we're coming to on this. It's not a set thing, and that's the wonderful thing about the Bible. It's not like you have a solution to every problem. It requires this struggle.
Thanks.